You've worked hard for what you have, your money, your assets, your 401k, and home. Isn't it all worth protecting? Nearly one in four consumers have been a victim of identity theft. LifeLock Ultimate Plus helps protect your finances with up to $3 million in reimbursement. LifeLock alerts you to identity threats you might miss. And if your identity is stolen, your dedicated U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. Let LifeLock help protect what you've worked so hard for. Save 25% off your first year on LifeLock Ultimate Plus at LifeLock.com/aware. Terms apply.
Hi, I'm Matt Lieb.
And I'm Vince Mancini.
And this is Pod Yourself the Wire. A The Wire podcast where Vince Mancini and I go through every single episode of The Wire
and talk about it.
I want to first and foremost thank everyone who has been giving us 5 stars in review on all of the, applicable podcast platforms. And I also want to thank people who heeded my warning or my advice about like moving over to Pod Yourself a Gun feed, because so far that's going really good. Sorry to have started a Pod Yourself the Wire feed. That was an accident.
Man, if only someone had suggested just keeping
shut
them on.
Shut the fuck. All right. I thought it'd be better for SEO to have a separate feed, and now I realize it's better to just have one big
turns
beautiful
out
feed.
SEO.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Very good. You did.
Count it.
You did great. So, and also there are still a few of you who haven't switched over. So remember, subscribe to Pod Yourself a Gun to get all future episodes of Pod Yourself the Wire. Simple. Makes sense.
Yeah.
This is going to go great.
We got it. Everybody's got
it. Okay. 5 stars in review on the platform. today, we are going to be talking about from season 2 of The Wire, episode 7, Backwash. Mm. And, our guest today is, he is a returning champion. You heard him on Pod Yourself a Gun, the Sopranos podcast. And he now has a new podcast called Shoot the Messenger. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest today is Nando Vila.
Well, I consider myself a humble motherfucker with a big ass dick. So it was very,
absolutely,
very fitting to be on this specific episode of the Pod Yourself the Wire, Wire podcast.
You are.
I'm just a humble motherfucker with a big ass dick.
Absolutely. You are the bunk of this here podcast. We're happy to have you here, and we are going to make fun of your weight. Just kidding. You have a.
I'm very self-conscious about that.
Yeah, so is Bunk. It makes a lot of sense. No, you have a great body. Let's start there.
Thank you.
Can we start with saying how handsome Nando is?
Mm-hmm. Keeps it tight, and I like that.
Keeps it tight. I like it. I like your setup. I see you've got like a bookcase in the background
yeah.
with various books.
Yeah.
So you're a heavy reader. I know yeah. that.
Well, you know, book buyer at least, you know. Who's
well,
got the time
I mean, yeah.
these days?
Yeah, you buy the. I do the same thing. I buy the books and then I listen to them, and then I pretend like I read them with my eyes.
That's good. I mean, I'm listening to Pod Yourself the Gun feed about The Wire all uh-huh. the time, so I don't have time for audiobooks.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, you know what? Shout out to you for listening to the correct feed, Pod Yourself a Gun, The Wire part. Is it confusing? Yeah, probably. Anyways, Nando, are you a fan of The Wire?
I am a fan of The Wire. Big fan of The Wire.
Sick.
Love The Wire.
Hell yeah.
Phew.
So, yeah. So that's good.
That's why I'm on the fucking podcast. What if I was like, I fucking hate that show.
You're like, what's that? Season 2 is a very controversial season.
Divisive.
Divisive, yeah. Some people
polarizing.
Love it, some people hate it. Polarizing.
Much like America, yeah.
Exactly,
it's a
dude.
Land of contrasts out there in the season 2 discourso sphere. I don't know.
There is no red America. There is no season 2 America. There is only the United States. You guys remember Obama?
I do. Uh-huh. How could I forget?
Yeah. Yeah. He was cool. So what were your thoughts of season 2 of The Wire?
Well, I was... rewatching The Wire now, it's been a while. It's been at least 10 or 15 years. I don't know, since
nice.
I watched The Wire. The first time I watched The Wire was when I was living in China and this was 2008-09, and this was still the era of DVDs. Like, streaming was not a thing yet. You know, people forget that there was a pre-streaming era.
Yeah.
And in China was like the, oh my God, it was like glory for DVDs, because they had these physical stores, brick and mortar stores, that sold bootleg DVDs.
Oh, that, you know, rules.
For like $2 for the box set of The Wire type of thing, you know?
I love that.
So I bought The Wire box set at my local neighborhood.
Were they good bootlegs, or was it like they someone were usually had to pretty sit good. In the living room recording The Wire?
No. This is like ripped from an actual DVD of The Wire that they purchased, and then they would put it on a good DVD. It was excellent, you know, and it was actually really funny. I was remembering now that I lived near this street that had a couple of these stores. The one that I used to go to was called Movie World, and it was like a Blockbuster Video, with all the bells and whistles, a checkout counter, like everything.
A guy working there, a teenager practicing his knife moves,
exactly. And but then as I was living there, across the street, another DVD store opened called Even Better Than Movie World.
Wow. I love that.
China is a great place if you guys ever been. If you have a sense of humor, China is the best. But so I bought the box out of The Wire and just plowed through it while I was in China. I did not watch it as it was airing on HBO. I think famously, like, very few people did.
Yeah, no, neither.
And then I watched it again. Right, I watched most of it again. I don't know if I got through the whole show, but I did watch it. You know, rewatching season two, this episode now. I mean, I was shocked at how much I remembered, and that was a long time ago. And I don't remember, you know, anything from The Bear, which I saw last year and I liked a lot. You know?
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, man, it was great to revisit.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like. Well, first of all, you lived in China. Do you speak Mandarin?
I did when I was there. I was pretty conversational. I studied in college.
What a pengyo.
Exactly.
You are my friend.
But it is. And then new to pengyo is girlfriend. So, I forgot new to most pengyo. Of it.
Sorry, I don't know how to say my wife in Borat in Chinese.
Oh yeah!
So you were living in China, and you were watching The Wire, and you were like, when you got to season two, initially, did you have the reaction that I think a lot of people did, which is like, who are these guys, and why are we here at the docks?
I remember thinking like, why do they relegate McNulty? I like McNulty. You know, in retrospect, it's like one of the boldest kind of creative decisions in the history of television or whatever.
Absolutely.
But like, I had clearly like identified, oh, this is like this is our guy. You know, McNulty is our guy, and now he's like not in the show, but he's like in the show. Like, they didn't kill him off. They're just like, you know, have him riding around boats every once in a while and doing bullshit. And I was like, why did they do that to poor McNulty? It just felt really jarring at first, but. I think over time, and it's probably on my second watch of season two, I appreciated it more. And, you know, this is going to sound like a fucking, you know, obnoxious Bernie bro take, but like, it really is just kind of, you just don't see depictions of organized labor in
100%
modern American culture. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, if you grew up in the 50s and 60s or 70s, like, all this stuff would be kind of just obvious to anyone. But by the early 2000s, which, like, you know, by then, you know, like 10% of the American workforce is unionized or whatever. Like, the shit seems alien and foreign to the vast majority of people, and felt kind of radical in a way.
Yeah. I completely agree. It definitely was like the first time that I had ever seen a show tackle not just like, usually the way the media does unions is in a kind of Jimmy Hoffa-esque type way, I guess. Yeah. And not, this isn't that far off from that, I guess. But but in a way that is actually sympathetic to them, rather than looking at them as like, unions are that thing when the mafia controls the workers. And it's like, nah.
No, it's empathetic in the sense that it's like, I don't know if it's sympathetic or whatever, but it's definitely like, it shows why one you know, would why a union would kind of turn towards that, you know?
Right. Yeah, because you can drink in the morning, and and your guys, they'll clock you out when they want to clock you out, and you can do graft to make a little extra lobbying money.
Yeah, and also on a more serious note, it is kind of. It shows that like a group of workers who have a union actually have at least some sort of foothold in the levers of power in a local community, rather than now, which is like if you're a worker in, you know, most people are non-union, you can be discarded. You have no power. The power, the app, it has all the power.
No, you have to do, you have to start a podcast just to claw back any semblance of independence.
Exactly.
It's true. It's sad, but true. Listen, I am from the ethnic white demographic. From, you know, like generations of union people. But we chuck that out when we send our kids to college. We put them, you know, we tried to. I guess I'm more like the lobbyist guy who's
also Italian.
Also
Italian.
Yeah.
Finally, we have
Polish guy. You know, fuck that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. These Polish. You know, they want to stay in the union. They don't want to. They don't want to try and grift their kids into an Ivy League school. Stupid.
Yeah. So then, that guy definitely started a podcast. That kid's son, the Princeton guy.
Oh yeah. Why is he going to Princeton to do whatever he wants? He just starts a podcast. Hey, what's up? This is the Get Money Quick NFT Crypto Podcast. Are you ready to ape in? Well, Jason DiBiago is.
That is such a perfect encapsulation of the completely crumbling worldview that my generation was like inculcated with. Like, go to like a college and do good, and you can do anything. You can fucking suck some corporate dick is what you're gonna do.
That is one of the great scenes, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. This is not a podcast about Jason DiBiago starting a podcast. No, this
could be
is a The Wire podcast, and we of course cannot start the pod without first playing the theme song.
When you pod to the garden, you gotta
pod
go back. Well, I beg your
pod
in. Walk the straight
podcast
track. If you
pod
with Jesus, he's gonna save
the docks.
You gotta keep the
Polish pod
down in the hole.
Season 2.
All right, everyone. Once again, this is today we're going to be talking about from season 2 of The Wire, episode 7, Backwash. This episode came out July 13th, 2003. Vince, can you break us off a little piece of that synopsis?
I sure can. Nicky gets accustomed to his role as Kingpin. Ziggy gets accustomed to his role as Fredo.
Yep, and there's a lot more that happened, but it's really hard to do a synopsis for this show because there's 1,000 storylines.
You could just, you know, use the real synopsis.
No, have you read the real synopses? They are very long.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
They're too long. Yeah. Like, just, you know, so... All right, Vince, what was happening at the time that this episode came out?
Yeah, that's right, Matt. You know, if we're going to talk about a cultural product, we can't talk about it divorced of its cultural context. We got to put some of that context back in, and we're going to do it using a little something we like to call the back in the day machine.
This is Vince Mancini, and I have a confession to make.
Oh, sorry. that was my deep fake Vince. Hold on.
I like big honking wieners inside all my holes. Stuff me like a Thanksgiving turkey and baste me with that sweet Matt Lieb cum.
All right. Sorry, wrong sting. My bad, dude.
Weird. All right. Get those mixed up.
Okay, now here's
the sting. You blew it. It tastes so yummy.
Okay.
And is my favorite bedtime snack. I'm Vince Mancini, and I am gay.
Here it is.
It's a bad time for newspapers. The news hole is shrinking as advertising dollars continue to decline.
There ain't no back in the day.
Machine tells the tale, son.
That's right. We're going all the way back to July 13th, 2003. What a day. What a year. Some of the headlines going on at the time. Iraq Al-Qaeda ties overstated, ex-officials say.
What?
Mm-hmm.
U.S. What
troops
are they thinking?
Searching Iraq, unable to find connection. Weird.
Shocker.
I don't know about that. I don't think that's true.
Yeah. In lighter news.
Iraq is Al-Qaeda. I'm sorry.
In lighter news, this was a favorite headline of mine. Top Italian courts slaps Roman hands. Roman as in, you know, like Roman around.
Double entendre.
It is the most ancient of Roman traditions. Rimorchiare, a kind of aggressive flirtation. And the male whistles and gropes that all too often go along with this battle of the sexes.
Ancient Roman tradition.
It gets better. It gets better.
You know, I love it. A culture's listen, tradition
Vince,
is that
Vince,
when
I know
you squeeze the button, you go.
They were like fucking walking across the forum. It was like, Mamma mia, che cosa va bella. Love your mama. You know, just grabbing
tits. And here we have an ancient painting of the gladiator. Is going, mommy. let me just read this sentence again because it's a really good sentence. And the male whistles and gropes that all too often go along with this battle of the sexes are as integral to the Italian experience as gelati.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's,
oh my God,
that's true.
The early aughts were fucking wild. Like September 11th through. Like 2004, it was like people don't realize just how fucking insane that era
was. We were
was.
Like, we saw people fall off the towers. We have no time for political correctness at all.
Yeah, exactly. We're all traumatized, so we got to just talk about how it's part of the Italian culture to do a sexual assault.
Or they were. Now it seems they're about to go the way of throwing Christians to the lions after the Cassazione, the country's highest court, ruled last week.
Wait, are the Christians the guys doing the groping?
No, they're saying that was an obsolete cultural practice, just like a grabbing the bottom is about to become.
Oh, okay, okay.
The court ruled
last week. What newspaper is this in?
This is the Daily Telegraph, like obviously.
The New York Times.
This is Time Magazine.
Ruled last week that a pat on the bottom counts as sexual violence, an imprisonable offense.
Yeah.
Well.
It's continued on the back page. I gotta continue that story.
Please.
Because I know you want to hear the rest of this.
No, yes, of course.
Yeah, so this is a British paper, which helps explain some of the, you know.
Yeah.
It has not always been so. 2 years ago, the same court scandalized feminists by overturning the 18-month sentence of a healthcare worker from the Venice area who groped a colleague's buttocks, then threatened to block her career if she reported him. Bottom pinching, the Cassazione declared, was acceptable as long as it was a single or isolated action. Hey, Giuseppe, you want to grab the bottom one time?
You get one freebie. Hey,
it's so bellissimo, I had to touch.
Yeah. You cannot even flirt with somebody at work no more.
Last week,
I don't know how to talk to a woman.
Last week, however, the court was considerably more severe in judging a 58-year-old man described by police as a serial bottom pincher who tried his luck on a woman in her 20s while she was selling ice cream in her parents' bar in Rieti, 100 kilometers east of Rome. The defendant was found guilty of an effective and concrete intrusion into the sexual sphere of the victim and awarded a 14-month suspended sentence.
Holy shit. Man. I mean,
Italy's wild, man.
Here's a little more about the actual cult. The same rules, the panel of judges announced, would be applied to the mano morta, the old custom, much favored by taxi drivers, of sticking a hand through a car window and resting it on a passing female bottom.
What is
the mano, the dead hand? It's just like in Scary Movie. Like, take my strong hand.
Fuck this! I'm sorry. Like they're acting like it's an ancient custom to have cabs.
No, to stick for the cab drivers to stick their hands out of the cab windows.
Right, but how long have they had cabs?
How long have cars? Did they used to
at
have
least
cabs
a
on donkey?
Year.
Yeah. This is an ancient custom. My grandfather grabbed the bot. My great grandfather grabbed the bot.
First person quoted, Alessandra Mussolini, the granddaughter of the dictator and an MP for the right-wing National Alliance, agrees wholeheartedly with the decision.
Oh, no.
Wow.
She's
a lib cuck. Yeah. Secret lib, you know?
This ruling is completely correct. Pinching the bottom is sexual harassment always if the lady doesn't want it. Even if she is wearing a little skirt.
Mussolini's granddaughter is woke. Italy's wild. Have you guys? There's this Twitter account that just posts random pictures of Italian female politicians. That like it's like you know the state treasurer in you know Emilia Campagna. And it's like just some woman like yeah, who just like just looks like a stripper. Yeah.
it makes sense now why she added that even if they're wearing the short skirt. I love that. It's just like. No, I understand the short skirt look like it's please grab my cool, but it is not mean that. That's very nice. It's cool to know that she's so woke, you know?
Yeah.
This is my own headline, but it was, yeah. President Bush congratulates elephants for fucking.
Okay.
This is another one from crazy ass Linda Stasi from the New York Post. This is about.
Is she a favorite of the pod or something? Like you guys just check in?
Yeah, she is. Because it's weird. Like I start looking through post headlines from the early aughts, and there's always one that is just like, what the fuck is this person even talking about? And it's always Linda Stasi, just like stream of consciousness, completely unhinged.
Yeah. Proto blogging style of writing where you're like, you got paid to do this.
Yeah.
This is crazy.
So this is in. It's regarding President Bush's trip to Africa. Possibly moved by the visit of the biggest Republican ever in their backyard, elephants proved that not everything is bigger in Texas by having elephant sex right in front of the president, First Lady Laura, and daughter Barbara. After the impromptu sex show ended, the president inexplicably hopped out of the truck and began stroking the elephant's trunks to the alarm of Secret Service agents. And the shock of his wife, who was still recovering from the elephant sex show.
He wasn't stroking something else.
His wife, oh dear, he's drinking again.
You two look great out there.
It's kind of crazy because it's like, this is it's a weird article because it's like, weird that he has time on his hands now. Of all the times for President Bush to not be super busy, like too busy.
No, Cheney was like, hey, we got wars to do. Go out and watch the elephants fuck, would you?
Yeah, yeah. It's like, hey, can I pet the elephants again? I love that. Cheney's just running the war. What a time to be alive, man.
Yeah.
I was around then. I remember.
We're all the same age, right? Like more or less. Like we remember that era. It's wild. Like, the kids these days like don't understand.
It was dark. We knew at the time that it was dark. Like no one was under any illusions.
Like America was like fully fascist, you know, for like two, like just straight up, you know, the media was like all in lockstep, and it was just there was no dissent at all, and I mean, the Trump era, like, doesn't even, it pales in comparison to
it's
to
not
that
close.
Era.
I mean, that's the next article will illustrate this point. Like, this was the Iraq invasion had happened. We had failed to find the connection, which was like the entire reason that the stated every stated reason for invading had basically proven false by this point. And this article is the president's overall approval rating dropped to 55% from 61% in a poll earlier this year.
Like, we're 55%.
What the fuck?
Dude, we were all on board with that shit. Like, it was just like, yep, let's fucking go, baby.
It was like, we lived in like this traumatized country, and it was it's funny because you know you see now that like you know people talk about how polarized everything is, and it's like, you know, and gridlock in the fucking, you know, Senate and House and all that stuff. And it's like, yeah, but you know what's way scarier than that? Is when everyone is marching in
the
lockstep.
Same batshit thing.
Yes.
And to
even mention like, hey, maybe maybe that's not true, is like everyone's like, wow, so fucking didn't know a goddamn terrorist was here. Right. Like you couldn't say shit.
This is a year before the 2004 presidential campaign, which people forget was Kerry versus Bush. And Kerry was running on a platform of he would have sent even more troops to war than Bush. And then Bush was just like a fucking pussy for not sending the fucking more troops. Yep. You know? Yeah.
He ran on a platform of I go kite surfing sometimes.
It's a great time.
So that's what was happening.
That is what was happening.
At the time that this episode came out, that is the context. That's where America is at.
That's probably why no one watched this fucking show.
Exactly. Because there's too much critique going on. So I don't have a song this week. Vince or Nando, you can answer this question. If there was a while you're watching this episode, is there like a, what song would you have me parody to do this fucking episode, bro? Any song, like, what does this bring out in you? You know, you watch the episode and you're like, this feels like
I got it. So the scene where Nikki Sabatka is in the bedroom with his girlfriend or wife, whatever she is, she has not one but two Disturbed posters on the wall if you look closely.
And guided by voices, like, for some reason.
Which makes no fucking sense. But two Disturbed posters. So I think like a
I think
Down with the Sickness or something.
I think you might be right.
No, what's the Blink-182 song about suicide?
Adam's song?
Yeah, there you go. When did that come? That probably came out around the
same
time.
That's like in
the
90s,
right?
Though, isn't it?
Yeah, that's 90. That's like, or 2000.
1999. But still, it came out like 3 years before this episode, which has like, you know, a guy committing suicide. I think it'd be funny.
Is there a suicide? Oh, D?
Yeah. Well, he was killed.
Yeah, that's not a suicide, bro.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, that's true. You know, but they think it's a suicide. Everybody's everybody's sort of grappling. I mean, the song is about people like grappling with the suicide. So, for all intents and purposes, everybody but Stringer is like treating this like it's a suicide.
Right. Nando was right. It is definitely Disturbed. so I will. I'll figure that out at some point. At the end of the episode, you'll hear what I did. So. We'll see if that's good. All right. So, talking about this episode, Backwash. There's a few different storylines going on. We have some continued movement with the detail where they're finally kind of like setting a trap for the dock workers.
Playing a cat and mouse game.
Playing a cat and mouse game with them.
That was
dock
actually
workers.
Pretty exciting how they did that. That whole thing.
Yeah.
The whole
thing. It was. And then we have, of course, the kind of blowback or the aftermath of what happens after Dee's murder, which was made to look like a suicide. And Stringer is now the big boss man. He really is all alone out there. We see what he does with that power. We have Nikki and Ziggy, who are kind of now cemented into their positions of like Nikki is going to be the drug kingpin while Ziggy is going to be he's real Fredo of this episode. I think he is decided that he's a big goof dumbass and that he doesn't he's just not smart enough to do the things that he wants to do. And then we have Frank Sabatka, who is really
sentimental old Pollock is what he is.
He's a sentimental old Pollock, and he's trying to hold on to what he has, and he's living in a brave new world where there are robots who are taking his
jobs. He's thinking
jobs.
That with enough, if he just talks to the right people, the past will return again.
Absolutely. He's trying to make America great again, and let's see if he does. General thoughts on this episode. Vince?
Pretty solid. Like, I feel like that intro with Nikki, the Nikki storyline. What's that?
Oh, with Nikki. I'm sorry.
The Nikki storyline feels a little like a Taylor Sheridan plot line, where it's like somebody goes up to the white guy who thinks he's black and tells him why he's wrong, and it all works out fine.
I don't know how to tell you this without hurting you deeply. First of all, you happen to be white. I'm talking raised on Rapola Street white. Or your mama used to drag you down to St. Casimir's just like all the other little piss pants on the block. Second, I'm also white. Not hang on the corner, don't give a fuck white. But Locust Point, IBS Local 47 white.
I don't work without no fucking contract. And I don't stand around listening to horseshit excuses like my cousin Ziggy, who, by the way, is still owed money by you and all your down streetwise wiggers.
Like, that's exactly like a Taylor Sheridan show, like some fucking, some classically masculine white guy would come into town, would breeze into town and tell everybody why the way
pretending
they do
things to be black
is stupid and they're
better. I love that scene because I was thinking the whole time, like, how weird a Zoomer might find that scene, like, this is not a thing anymore,
right?
You know, this was like a very much a live issue in the 90s. I mean, I'm sure we all knew that guy growing up, and it was like a very, it was a flashpoint and it was like a whole thing, and now that just seems so quaint and you know, like, it's like not a thing anymore, you know what I mean? And like they'd be like,
totally,
this guy's
it's weird because, you know, I'd never thought about it that way before, but you're right, like, now that level of, I guess, kind of like appropriation, I guess, of like, you know, being a white kind of like hype boy, a white Mike, if you will. Like, that's just like every influencer on TikTok is like.
Yeah, I think a huge part of it is that I think with streaming music, everyone has become kind of like multi-genre,
right?
Right.
In their music taste, like almost like you have to be, you know, to be cool. Like you have to love fucking Miles Davis and Eminem and Nirvana. You know what I mean? Like, whereas like in the 90s, you were not, that was like considered absolutely sacrilegious to not sort yourself into one firm genre of music. And that was like a huge part of your identity.
True.
And if for whatever reason you liked hip hop, you know, you had to only like hip hop. You couldn't like hip hop and Nirvana, or else you were a fucking poser.
Right, exactly. It had to be your lifestyle. The music was the whole thing.
Your whole kind of affect had to reflect whatever it is.
Which is bad, but also like music was more important then, simply because like we had not devalued the act of like listening to music. Like I can't remember the last time like an album came out and I'm like, oh, I remember that album. I mean, it just doesn't, it doesn't happen anymore. Whereas
it still happens, but you just have to,
but not in the same way.
It's not
a cultural event.
It's not a cultural event.
That's true.
Like people are not I spent most of my teens like hanging out at Tower Records and like buying fucking CDs and looking at CDs and thinking about CDs, and people don't really do that anymore.
It's a more rare.
They have it all at their fingertips.
When you're trying
to
open the CD with the little plastic thing on the top, and it was a fucking pain in the ass. And then, like, one out of every 10 times, you broke the CD case or like a little piece chipped off, and you're like, oh, you know,
that was $40. But yeah, no, I mean, I definitely think that, like, watching Nicki kind of like, he's like, I'm going to do this thing that I told Ziggy not to do, not to get mixed up with. And, you know, because you don't want to get shot like a Project N-word, as he says. Watching him like decide, OK, I will actually do this, but I'm going to do it whitely.
Yeah.
And
it's exactly what it is.
He's like, you know, I'm going to do it as a proud white man, which you're like, I don't know. I love this version of Nicki. I mean, I sympathize with him because, you know, he's definitely got backed into a corner here. I mean, you know, he's not getting the days of work that he needs to get, and he's got a girlfriend and a kid, and he lives in his mom's basement. Like shit sucks, and he's being given this opportunity to like not just sell drugs, but also he has muscle behind him with the like Greek and the fucking Sergey.
I think,
like,
as always, you can acknowledge the problems of the white working class without justifying his solutions to them.
Oh, completely. Yes. No, I mean, and to be absolutely clear, I'm not even against him being a guy who sells drugs. I just think the way in which he's kind of carrying himself. He's so quickly turned from like, you know, no, we're, you know, we're dock boys and we're stevedores and that's what we do. And, you know, and Ziggy, don't get into that shit. It's, you know, it's bad and not worth it. He so quickly turned from that to like a guy who's like, oh, I'm going to buy like a big car and I'm going to go around to this, like, I mean, Frog, the guy he's yelling at. I feel bad for, because first of all, clearly he's got some sort of fetal alcohol syndrome going on. Like, he's not the normalest of guys. And second of all, like, I said this before, but like, sometimes with guys like that, like, Nikki's talking shit, but like, that sometimes that's just how they grow up and that's just how they talk, you know what I mean? And I, you know, him being like, you know, stop doing this, you know, gangster, you know, black wannabe stuff. It's almost, I don't know. It's a little bit.
I mean, it feels real to the time to me.
Oh, sure. 100%. Yeah. 100% feels real.
It feels real to the time, but it's weird. The way the show, it makes it feel like we're supposed to identify with Nikki, just like telling right. this guy what's what, like yeah. laying down some wisdom. Like, it feels like we're supposed to be on his side, and you're kind of like, I don't know about that.
Meanwhile, so Ziggy, he gives Ziggy a bunch of money that he like Ziggy did not earn this money.
No, keeps giving Ziggy completely unearned kickbacks.
Yeah, he's giving him half, which is like something he's doing, you know, I think, partially because he's family and he's doing it out of the goodness of his heart, kind of. But also,
I guess, I mean, this made,
he's flexing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it made sense that he's giving him his fucked up package money. Like, that made more sense than him getting Blue Book value on his stupid car in the last episode.
And Ziggy like has this great moment, which is like he almost is like word for word doing a Fredo thing where he's just like, you know, I'm smart, you know, and I deserve respect. But it's like he's doing it in a way where he's like, I'm not smart and I don't deserve respect, I guess. And I have a clip.
What'd Frog say? Here's a couple of hundred extra, make a little fucking goof happy.
Goof.
This is for my thing, Nick. Fuck if you ain't handle that business better, too.
See, we're making money.
It's your move, Nikki. I got other issues right now.
Priscilla Catlo. Oh, Jesus, Nick. You knocked up Prissy Catlo?
I only fucked her once.
Christ, everybody down the point fucked her the once, Zig.
This whole storyline where Nikki is just, or sorry, where Ziggy is just sitting at a bar drinking his pain away because he got...
Smoking cigarettes inside. I love it. Oh, yeah. Man, I miss those days.
He's being real emo about the fact that he knocked up the local hooer, I suppose.
The village bicycle.
The village bicycle. Prissy Catlo. And you find out later that it's all a ruse for Maui and the other doc boys to just make fun of him, I guess, which is kind of...
Yeah, it's payback for... Why is your dick in my computer?
He has like a really big dick, right? I remember this.
Huge dick. Huge. Yeah. Giant Polish dick.
Kielbasa.
Yeah. He's got a real kielbasa sausage. And then Nikki kind of like puts the pieces together and is like, wait, you can't get mailed papers to be served. Someone has to give them to you. It's like a court official. And he calls up the law firm, and Maui picks up and he says,
Shyster, Shyster, Shyster.
No child, never meant to be. No child, boy, poverty.
Which I thought it was great.
How did you take that?
Okay, so this is what I was thinking. When I watched it, I was like, oh, that's very funny. And then I was like, is that anti-Semitic? And I had to like look into the history of the word shyster. And shyster is not, I think, initially wasn't an anti-Semitic. It doesn't have an anti-Semitic origin. It was like, it's not like a Yiddish for like bad Jew or something. It's based off of the word scheiße. Shit, right? In German. And I think it just means like a shitty criminal type thing. Mm. So a shyster is someone who's like deals in shit.
A dung beetle,
sure. Mm-hmm. But I will say that I think at this point, shyster feels like a slur, so it's probably a little bit of a...
I think it was intended as one in the context of
Maui. I think it was too, but
I feel like
I associate it more with lawyer than Jew.
Of course, but...
Yeah, but it was a little... Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but it's like an anti-Semitic. It is.
There's no way in which Maui is not a little bit picturing three like rabbi lawyers
or Levy.
Right, exactly. But anyways, I thought that was a fantastic scene, mostly because the entire time in the rewatch, I was like, oh yeah, they are just playing Love Child on repeat over and over, and
just making themselves miserable for that shitty joke.
It's like, yeah, they're really sitting around going, this better be fucking worth it, dude.
It's like that joke in what was the Will Ferrell cop movie, The Other Guys or something like that, where
he learns
Mark Wahlberg learns to tap dance to make fun of the kid who likes to tap dance or whatever.
Yeah, he learns to do it ironically or sarcastically. But he gets really good. That is Nikki and Ziggy. They are
two guys, they're two young drug dealers on the make.
Absolutely. Meanwhile, let's talk about Father Sobotka, the senior Sobotka. This episode, we see the union boys watching a presentation about automation, and they very quickly realize that their jobs are about to be completely fucked. Because
of the goddamn globalists.
Goddamn globalists making these globalist robots. And Frank is, he's not trying to give up his secretary treasurer position in the union, and he wants to like keep it. And we finally get a little bit of what's going on between the budgeting and the grain pier, and there's a lot of like complicated shit when it comes to this like storyline, because you're like, I know Frank wants the grain pier, or no, he wants the canal to get dredged.
He wants both. It's sort of like Frank's thing is like, you got to ask big, and then, you know, the other guy thinks you get the thing you want by asking specifically for that thing.
He's like a Democrat, and
exactly.
Frank is like a Bernie bro. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yes. 100%.
Basically what it Pretty is. Much, like, if you can't get it, you shouldn't even ask for it.
Yeah, right. You know,
it's like Chuck Schumer,
exactly.
Chuck Schumerism.
No. The best way to negotiate is to start with just asking for a little tiny bit. And then if they're like, no, you go, okay, sure, I'm sorry. That's the true Democrat way. So I finally was like, okay, I need to kind of like look up some of this port jargon. And so this whole granary storyline is actually based on like a real grain pier that was or grain elevator that was happening at Locust Point in Baltimore Harbor. So it was Silo Point is what it's called, formerly known as the Baltimore and Ohio Locust Point Grain Terminal Elevator. This is a residential complex that converted a high-rise grain elevator on the edge of the Locust Point neighborhood in Baltimore, Maryland. So there's this whole storyline that's happening is with the grain pier, if they don't get the funding to, I guess, renovate, then it's going to be taken by Andy Krawczyk, who's a land developer, and they're going to make a high rise out of it. And this is a thing that actually did happen. And it happened in fucking 2009. Mm. It was converted in 2009 from a grain elevator to a condominium tower, which is, this is what, let me do math, 6 years after this show, is... For me,
how long does it take to build, though? They probably had the designs and stuff already.
No, sure. But I look at it as like the ultimate proof that like art does not do anything.
this art was like about an inevitable
force, basically. Like, sure. I don't think it was.
And it
ever
wasn't
in
a popular
question.
Enough show to maybe like
even in
get
the in the world
to...
of the show, I don't think it was really ever in question that
the tides of progress are not to be
the long term
sort of institutional kind of rot is not to be overturned.
Yeah, the long shermen were going to get fucked. Like, I think the writers of the show knew that. Everybody except the longshoreman in the show knows that.
Frank is fighting against the tide, and he knows this.
He's a hard-headed Pollock.
He's trying to will his way of life into a continued existence, and he's doing it through shoeboxes of money that he gives to a lobbyist, which money well spent. I've been wondering this whole time about what exactly they mean by dredging the canal. I know what dredging a canal is, making a canal bigger, but what canal are they talking about? So I'm going to read to you about this particular canal. Baltimore is a semi-terminal harbor situated at the top end of Chesapeake Bay. Therefore, large cargo ships on their way up to the eastern seaboard must turn around at Baltimore and exit the mouth of the bay in southern Virginia in order to resume their worldly travels. But there's a 15-mile canal between Upper Chesapeake and the Delaware Rivers. This canal is so narrow that ships can't, big giant container ships, which is like now the majority of these shipping containers, these ships, can't actually get through it, or they can only go one at a time. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to widen this canal in order to get more ships in. So, you know, for those of you who've been like watching the show and every time they mention dredging or they mention the grain pier, all you hear is Charlie Brown's teacher going, wah, 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 wah. That's what they're trying to get done.
They're trying to Matt's mom that canal is what they're
fucking
trying to, just trying to
shit
stretch it out.
You're trying to stretch it out. I know. You piece of shit. Oh, okay. You think I'm just gonna let that go,
they
Vince?
They need more semen going through there. Is what they need,
Vince.
Vince Mancini, and I have a confession to make. I like big honking wieners inside all my holes.
You said this.
Stuff me like a Thanksgiving turkey.
That's you, idiot.
Sorry to interrupt all of your canal dredge talk and semen in your mom's canal stuff, but we do have to take a break for ads.
Oh. All right. Well, thank you, Brent. Before we get
segue to our advertisers.
They love it, folks. Yeah.
Speaking of my mom's canal getting dredged, please take a short break to listen to these wonderful advertisements and buy these products. I'm sure they're good, and we will be right back.
First you dredge and then you batter, you know?
Shut the fuck.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
And we are back. Oh boy, I hope you enjoyed all those ads. So we get to my favorite scene of the episode. It's the one in which Frank has a conversation with lobbyist Bruce DiBiago. And we talked about that in
the
beginning
of
this episode. I do.
Okay,
I do.
Let's hear it.
It's a long scene, and it's also Chris Bauer. It's like the moment where, again, you're just like, this guy is miles ahead of like pretty much every actor that he is surrounded by in the show. Like most of the port people seem like kind of half actors, half like real guys. And he's just like, he's a brilliant actor. And he in the scene has one of the coldest like burns that I think I've seen on the show so far.
Jason's at Princeton.
Princeton. And after he graduates, he's gonna do what?
Whatever he wants.
Right. You know, back when we was kids, Danny Hare's father stole a couple cases of cognac off a ship. Except when he gets it home, it ain't cognac. It's Tang. TV was saying it's what the astronauts drank on their way to the moon. You drank it, well...
Then you could be an astronaut, too.
All summer long, that shit was all the hair kids drank. What do you think they grew up to be? Stevedores. What the fuck you think? Something tells me Jason DiBiago will grow up and squeeze a buck the way his old man did.
That is, like... In terms of a burn, the most circuitous route.
Yeah, I barely even understood that when I the first time.
Yeah, I didn't either. Just like I knew it was like tone wise, I was like, I know he's saying something mean.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, what he's saying is that, you know,
going to Ivy League school is just like your tang. It's not going to make you a wasp.
It's not. No, it's not. It's not that. It's that you know, everyone I grew up around. One summer we all drank Tang because we were going to be an astronaut. You know, if you drink a Tang, you're going to be an astronaut. But our situation is such that we're all just going to become stevedores because that is what we're surrounded by. That is the job that we get out here. That's our prospects. And he's saying, in the DiBiago family. Your tradition is going to be getting jobs that just squeeze a buck out of someone. Doesn't matter that he's going to fucking Princeton to do whatever he wants. The truth of it is he's probably going to be a hedge fund guy. He's probably going to run a private equity firm and destroy a bunch of businesses to make a profit. And that is, it's a very circuitous route to get to that burn, but I thought it was sharp as shit. I really liked
sharp,
it.
Much like the knife sharpener that DiBiago's great grandfather did when he first arrived from the motherland when he was sexually harassing all of the women on the block in fucking Baltimore. He was just sharpening my knife.
Yeah, I sharpen a knife. I punch it a butt.
Listen, the Night of the Long Knives would have never happened if not for that guy's great grandfather.
Wow.
It would have been like the night of the clubs.
Night of the dull knives.
Yeah. Night of the sharp sticks.
My great-grandfather was a knife sharpener. Pushed a grinding stone up Preston Street to Alice Ann, one leg shorter than the other from pumping the wheel. And since he didn't want his sons to push the goddamn thing, he made sure my grandfather finished high school and my old man went to any college that would take him.
Talking history, right? I'm talking now. Because down here it's still who's your old man till you got kids of your own. Then it's who's your son. But after the horror movie I seen today, robots. Piers full of robots. My kid will be lucky if he's even punching numbers 5 years from now. And while it don't mean shit to me that I can't take my steak knives to DiBiago and Sons, it breaks my fucking heart that there's no future for the Sabatkas on the waterfront.
He responds the way I think most upwardly mobile whites do. Like third, fourth generation white immigrants do, which is you just talk about ancient history in which one time you had a family member who did something poor people do.
Yeah, he did a working class job back in the day. Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, but what's so great about that scene too, in the writing of it, is that, you know, Frank is also like he's it's like that thing like you're mad at me, but you're mad at yourself. You know, He fucking fucked his own kids by not preparing them or giving them a 100% different life.
He didn't tell them to learn to code.
Exactly. Yes. You know? And it's like, yeah, that's shitty, but like also kind of true. Like
you can be a sentimental asshole or you can, you know, try and read the room a little.
It's
even if the room sucks, even if reading the room, even if it sucks, even if it's shitty reading, you still got to do it.
It's the thing I think I'm the most conflicted about, because on the one hand, I am like, I agree. I'm like, this is an inevitability. I mean, especially once he sees, you know, how many stevedore jobs are going to be lost through automation.
Yeah. And he's already like, why would big ships come to Baltimore? It makes no sense. That's why we have to fight harder. And you're like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Seems like you know you're fighting a losing battle, but...
But you fight on anyway because you're trying to preserve your way of life, getting drunk with all your dudes and chanting no wives at the bar. You know?
But it is a tragedy. Yeah, reminiscing.
That's why the ending of the show is so great, because it's like... He sort of realizes what they're like reminiscing about is this fucking job where you just get horribly maimed every now and then. Yeah. And that's just like standard.
Yeah.
That's why they have such a close bond, is because they've probably seen like three of their friends die from falling equipment.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but at the same time, while I am like, yeah, dude, just, yeah, you should have sent Ziggy to community college. He, like, he's not good at anything, but he could probably, like, I don't know, man. Like, he could learn, like, he likes computers.
He would be a good, he's like smooth with women from what I remember. You know, like, that's a transferable skill to corporate America. Like, absolutely. He could have been, like, some fucking marketing guy
or something.
I was just going to say,
like, you know, perfect what I mean? Marketing guy right there.
Yeah. Exactly.
He just walks into a room and immediately compares the client to Bullwinkle and the yeah, right. from Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Yeah, yeah. He walks in and then tries to show them his dick, and they're like, "You're hired." No, but I on the other hand, I'm conflicted because like Frank, it's a shitty situation, which like Frank is really mourning the fact that this, it isn't just about like the job. It's also about like, in a more broad perspective, about the death of unions and the,
yeah,
the death
solidarity
of,
yeah,
yeah,
you know, like he has genuine solidarity with his like union brothers, but like the I think one of the lessons of The Wire and why the show works so well and has endured so well is that if you have any sort of sentimentality in this kind of in this shitty rotten system, like, mm-hmm. you're going to lose. That the people who win are the cynics who are just playing the game and don't give a fuck. And like Rawls, like I was like, Rawls is the cynic in this, 100%. This episode, you know what I mean? And he's up there. I don't remember like what his post is, but he's like a high up guy in the rotten institution. And, mm-hmm. and Daniels has like some level of like just earnest fucking dumbass trying to be a good cop, you know?
Right.
And it's like Rawls doesn't give a shit. And that's why he's, you know what I mean?
You have to be willing to play the game. You can't be sentimental.
And also like understanding where your power came from. Like Frank is still thinking that it's the 60s when labor could, you know, legitimately extract those concessions from the big companies, that because they were necessary at that point. Like these companies, like they didn't have anywhere to send all of their manufacturing back then.
Mm-hmm.
And then now fast forward 30 years, it's like you don't have the power base that you once had. So he's thinking like he's like looking at it like it's the great man theory of history, where if he just like gives the right speech to the right people at the right time, like it's gonna change like the macro tides of what's happening to his entire industry. And it's like, it's not. Like they're gonna build that fucking condo. Like,
yeah. Trying to hold on to power, I think, is like there. On the one hand, you have like in parallel the Barksdales trying to hold on to their power, right? Because you know Avon's in fucking in prison, and Prop Joe has all the good fucking dope now.
Of course, this is neither the time nor the place, but I thought I might get at you for a moment. Got a proposition here. Thing is, y'all got the best territory and no kind of product. I got the best product, but could stand a little more territory, so you see where this thing need to go.
Well, now, you know Avon fought real hard for them towers. I mean, we took down the Rayford brothers, Big Dennis Woodson, I mean.
Should have just been the string. Buy for a dollar, sell for two. That all it need be.
I didn't quite understand what, like, Prop Joe didn't exactly spell out what he wanted. He was sort of just like...
It's like a power-sharing thing, yeah. Like, they'll split the profits, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
We'll figure out a deal. Like, we can sell your shit, you know, we can sell my shit on your territories.
Right.
We'll just split the fucking money, you know what I mean? But the problem is that, you know, and I think this is one of the brilliant lessons of, like, I think, I mean, not to get ahead of ourselves, but the final scene of the show,
mm-hmm.
You know, at the end of the day, in a kind of illicit trade, you know, muscle and willingness to pull the trigger and just being like a fucking, you know, willing, like violent human being.
Yes.
Like that the smart businessmen eventually lose out. They need those guys in any kind of one of those situations. Mm-hmm. But like when the rubber hits the road, like just being willing to fucking kill someone with no remorse,
yes.
and just like out muscling someone still goes a long way in that kind of industry. You know, like the Prop Joes and Stringer Bells, like they're businessmen, but they fundamentally need that layer of violence on top,
right,
of it.
Right, because that in of itself is the thing that holds together this the power. Like you continue to hold on to power by flexing that kind of muscle. And it's not the same thing as, like, you know, two competing brands of well, like, soda.
It's like, did you see that show The Anarchists, where all the, like, libertarian yes. guys move yeah. to Mexico and they're like, oh, we can live in this libertarian fucking paradise where, like, the free market decides everything, and it's like, up, and then one of them got killed by drug dealers, and
right, yes,
like, is it right, like, all the things that you imagine happening in a place where, like, you know, the law doesn't apply and it's just the right. market. Yeah, well, there's the market.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, I obviously the drug business is always kind of like the really putting, it's like a sledgehammer of a metaphor for, like, free market capitalism. Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like the freest type of market is one that is only enforced through
private
violence. Yeah. So you've got both Avon and the Sabatkas. They're trying to hold on to their power. And I think if we get into just, like, a little bit of what's going on with the Barksdale situation, one of the things you were talking about was not understanding, like, the power sharing thing. Like, that is just,
like, clearly, like, he's mm-hmm. he would be letting Prop Joe get his foot in the door on the West Side. And I didn't entirely know what that means, because Avon seems to think it's like,
well, no, because Avon, the whole thing is the territory that was gained, the territory that they have, the Franklin Towers, that is owned because they fought for it.
Sure,
they like literally killed guys in order to get that yeah. territory. So that, and having that territory, which is the best territory in town because all of the fiends live there, or it's a quick walk for them, that, you know, they get all this profit from it. Like, why would, as soon as they start buying from Prop Joe, they're now,
yeah, as soon as they're in business with Prop Joe, you know, that this kind of, that Avon has a Manichaean view of these things. It's like, you know, that you, it's a war at all times for territory, and there's no quarter and no business to be done with someone else in that's on the other side. You know what I mean? And it's yes. like, this is fought through, this is territory that's fought for with blood and violence, and that, you know, that they will, if you let them in, if you let the wolf into the hen house, they're eventually going to kill you, you know,
right.
in some way, or eventually going to put you to pasture in some way.
And the reason they'll do that is not just because you let them in, but it's not just because they're there. It's because you also showed you're weak by allowing exactly. them to be there.
And if it's not Prop Joe himself, it's right. someone in his crew, you know, who's yes. going to see an opportunity or whatever, that, like, and that's always the thing with illicit trades, is that, like, it's just the guy who's willing to be the most violent is the yes. one who ends up kind of winning. And then that guy gets replaced by some other person who wants to be, you know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%. And I think, like, the, you know, you see with both Prop Joe and Stringer, but Stringer in particular, you see the, like, community college economics class in him is really like, but what if we could just do this and make money and, like, have peace and do business and stuff? And it's like, and Avon is like, no, this is gangster shit. You can't just change the rules of the game because you read a couple of yeah. Adam Smith cliff notes, you know? Yeah. Like, so I think as much as I agree with Stringer that it's like, yeah, no, I want it to be like, wouldn't it be sick if it was, like, peaceful and there wasn't all this death and stuff and you could just partner with your enemies?
Someone will come. Someone yeah. will come.
And I think Prop Joe knows that. I don't think Prop Joe is doing a Stringer by saying, like, hey, man, I too would rather there was peace and, you know, no, in
he's
this
sensing
game.
An opportunity. Of,
no, yeah. Sure. He's like, Avon's in prison, and now that D is dead, you know, because, like, D being dead means that Stringer is probably no longer sharing power with Brianna. So Stringer really is all alone here. So, yeah, Prop Joe sees it, and he's like, hey, I don't know if you know this, but I have a catchphrase.
Yeah.
I got a proposition for you. And I think the fact that that Prof Joe has a catchphrase and it's in his name.
And he knows, and like, he smirks when he does it because he's like, yeah, this is me.
Guess what I'm about to say? You guessed it. I have a proposition for you. And yeah, so I think he smells a little bit of blood in the water and he's trying to get in on that, you know, get on that sweet territory that he knows Avon wouldn't give up in a million years. And just real quick, there's this moment between Stringer and Avon where Stringer asks Avon about Dee's death in a way like he doesn't know what happened. Do you guys remember that Chris Rock bit where he says, like, you get robbed and then by your neighbor, and then he comes over later and he says, I heard you got robbed?
Yeah.
That's essentially what he's doing in this scene.
He's like, how are they thinking about it inside the prison? You know, like, what are they saying about it?
Yeah. So what have you heard? I have that clip.
You know, don't nobody want no shit like this to happen, man. If I would have known the boy was going to be doing some shit like that, man, you know what I mean?
What are the prison people saying?
Yeah.
That he just hung himself like that? Just tied a rope around the knob, sat his ass down.
Because I live next door to you, break in your house and come over the next day and go, I heard you got robbed.
It's 100%.
The performance is, I mean, the Idris Elba's performance as Stringer Bell is like, it's been so long, but I was just like, I slipped right back in. I was like, man, he's incredible.
He is.
Honestly, like,
just that little subtle hesitation there.
I still have never seen him do acting that's up to the standard. I mean, sorry.
Yeah.
Like, I have not, I don't remember another performance of his that is this
no.
good.
Yeah,
I mean, I've yet to watch another show, like TV show. I maybe if I watched Luther, I'd be like, oh shit, he's good in that too. Mm-hmm. But just like ever since this show, he has been kind of like a movie guy, and the shit that they put him in is like
Beast. You didn't see Beast?
Oh, I saw Beast. I love haven't seen Beast.
Is it good?
Oh, no, I thought it was great.
It's terrible.
Vince hated it. I don't know why. I was like, no, but he's the lion in bed. He got a little run from lion.
Oh, yeah, it's just boring. You don't even see, like, it's not even, you don't even see what's happening.
It's Jaws with lion.
Yeah, but a boat is cooler than him being in a car.
No, yeah, it's stuck in car. Lion smart.
Jaws have character.
Yeah, but he's so good in that scene. Just the him fucking stuttering. What are you heard anything? Anyone like say any different?
But not too much, you know. It's like it's not too obvious that he's. It's perfect. I don't know.
It's great. Yeah, it's very good. And Stringer is really now like you see kind of. You see all of his like plans are like coming together of him like consolidating his power and, you know, really not just being like the right hand man to Avon, but really by the time Avon gets out, being that second in command guy, like sharing power with him. So, yeah. Let's finally. I'm sorry. We also. Can we talk about one of the funniest cold opens in the history of the show?
Oh, man.
Oh, yeah. Bodie and the flowers, yeah.
Something in particular?
Funeral.
I'm sorry.
Nah, funeral, you know.
No, I mean I'm sorry for your loss.
Oh, yeah.
Well, who was it that passed? A relation?
Nah, we worked together.
I see. I think I'm on it. Follow me.
Hell yeah. See, this what I'm talking about.
That Gat and Grip thing over there sells a lot. How your boy fall?
Hung himself. I guess he couldn't handle all them years, you know? It's a weak-ass nigga when you think about it. But ain't no reason to drag his name down no further, you know? I tell you what, make it look like one of them towers down on Franklin Terrace. You know, the high-rises, right?
You want the arrangement to look like a high-rise housing project?
Hell yeah.
That's so fucking
it's so
good.
Dark.
It's so dark and it's so like
I like that they have so a back perfect. Room specifically for gangster funerals.
Yeah.
Which yeah, I know exists in Mexico. Like in Mexico that is for sure an industry. I didn't know that was one in Baltimore, but it makes sense, I guess.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen that like picture of like an embalmed like Mexican cartel gangster He's like embalmed and he's in his car.
Yeah.
They're like, amazing. We're going to bury him like that. And it's like, what?
Well, I just also love the writing in that scene is so good. Like the guy who plays the salesman has like his like front of the shop salesman talk, but then he's got his back of the shop salesman talk. And but he still has like a way. He's like, you know, like, how did he fall? You know what I mean? Like he's got like his, you know, like he's got like his whole shtick down. It's like perfect.
Yeah, he like it's a very like subtle code switch where he starts from a guy who's like condolences for your lost friend, and then just like
for your fallen like, brother. Yeah, now it's like you know, it's like a different thing. Yeah,
yeah, and then he's asking him how he fell. But yeah, that scene is just perfect because he ends up with like, Bodhi ends up asking him for the fucking the arrangement to look like the high rise. Housing project,
and it's such a good payoff when Pooh Boy was it, his name. Pooh Boy was that his name?
Poot.
Yeah. At the end, in the funeral, he's like, "Man, it looks fucking awesome." You know, like the towers. And he's like not in the episode. He just like pops up just to deliver that payoff for the cold oven.
And I love it too because you look at it, and I'm certain that half of that visual joke is that like no that thing looked unrecognizable
like what the fuck like, was that it was just like a squares bunch of squares
but Poot knows exactly what he was trying to do. He's like, man, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, so good. Just
it's
one
so
of the greatest.
Dark it's so dark like it's just like it's beautiful. It's lovely.
It's beautiful. And JD Williams once again crushing it as Bodhi, like playing this character so perfectly. Okay, so the final thing that we got to talk about is what's going on with the detail. I think what's going on with Daniels in particular is like really interesting because this whole episode they spend trying to get Daniels. Everyone's trying to get Daniels to take these 14 dead bodies. And he is refusing to do it because he's like, I'm only doing this detail so I can get out from under like Burrell's fucking punishment of making me work underground in evidence control. And Freeman ends up being the one, like you said, who gets him to actually have a little bit of shame.
Slick
about
Lester. Oh, doing the devil's work here.
You got that air of wisdom on you. It's such a great line.
Yeah. The fact that like Bunk like was buttering him up and just being like, no, you can convince him. You can do it. And he does. And he does it in a very,
well, it's kind of funny because you see like Landsman and Rawls trying to convince him, and they're just like these two like slovenly pieces of shit, just like blatantly licking their chops, like zero
literally
guile.
Eating while talking.
Well, that's I was gonna say, like the way he's peeling that orange, and then the way he bites into that orange is so disgusting and perfect. Like I don't know about you guys, how you guys eat an orange. I don't know how often you eat an orange, but like I take the slight. The slice, and then I put the whole slice in my mouth.
Yeah,
you know, he peels it, then takes like three slices and bites halfway into it. Like all the juices are like oozing out. It's like that's weird and gross.
I don't know how they eat oranges in Baltimore, but they don't have enough experience over there.
Yeah, it's extra disgusting, and it's like, of course, the way Rawls would do it, especially if he's trying to project power.
But it's funny
because
it's just like he's basically just being like, hey, you want to do this favor for me for no gain for yourself?
Yes.
And like that's basically his whole pitch is like, you know, it'd be nice for me if you did this thing that I want you to do. And Daniel's like,
I'd be your best friend.
Yeah, that's okay.
Well, he basically tells him like he won't forget it or something. And it's like he's basically implicitly offering that he's going to owe him. And, you know, obviously you can't trust him. I thought the Rawls, his performance was fucking great. I mean, again, I'm remembering all the performances and they're fucking great. You know,
like,
there's so many of them are fucking so good.
Rawls is just, he's got that, I don't know what, he's like a hawk eye where he looks like a sinister bird.
Yeah, like a really stupid hawk. Like he really has no other purpose than like spotting prey. Like he can't, he's got the reptile brain. Like he cannot... Could not solve a crime to save his life, but
no, but that's never
up.
Been his job,
and that's why he's high up. Who gives
exactly?
A shit,
yeah,
know?
No, he knows that the key to moving up is making other people solve the crime.
Yeah, yeah, and
not taking ownership of anything ever.
Yeah. And he's, you know, I also like at the end of that scene where Daniels is like, no, your offer of do this thing for no apparent gain is rejected.
Yeah. Summarily rejected.
And he's he's smarter than he looks, which I was like, I don't think you have to be that smart to know that you said you were basically like, no, this screws you mostly.
Yeah. But that's why Lester is such a snake in this episode, like just slyly convincing him to go completely against his own interests.
Yeah.
The Rolls came to me, asked if I would take the homicides.
You should. Those girls in the can really suffocated, Lieutenant. They really died in that fucking box. You pick this case up, you might eat those open murders. But you let it pass. You gotta ask yourself how you want to live your day to day.
Jesus. I mean, lays it on thick.
Yeah.
Where he's just like, you know, if you don't do this, I don't know how you're gonna sleep at night, dog. Yeah. Like, you might as well kill yourself.
Clearly not with his wife, who thought he was just like such a fucking dumbass cuck, you know, for taking the 14 homicides. His wife's like, this is not a turn on to me at all. And you go fuck yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. His wife Marla is interesting. It's to me is one of the more fascinating characters on the show because it's one of the more like real it's hard to write a character who's like this clearly overly ambitious person who is like so political that she's essentially in this relationship going like everything that you're doing has to look good for me and my eventual run for a political office, which we will come to see later. And usually when you write a ambitious character like that, who's in kind of this transactional relationship, you like hate that person. You're like, oh, you know, that person is bad. That person is like usually an evil young blonde.
Yeah. Lady Macbeth.
Yes, exactly. And but in this show, it's she's just kind of more sympathetic because you are looking at Daniels and going like, yeah, this is a kind of a stupid risk to take on these 14 Jane Does because hopefully the guy who screwed you over will be like, okay, we're even now. It's a big risk, and in that ending scene, he has a line. Daniels is like, I think he's describing why he loves the job, and Marla confuses it for describing why he loves her. And I have a clip of that.
But if the case does come together, I would at least have Rawls as a rabbi. It could still work for me.
Listen to yourself.
I love the job, Marla. I can't help it.
The job doesn't love you.
You know what I love? The mind that's always a step ahead of me. The person who never stops thinking it through. That's what I fell in love with first.
You know what I fell in love with first? Your ambition. Where'd that man go?
Cold.
Very cold. And kind of, I'm unsure of what he's talking about when
he's talking about her.
Yeah.
Right. But he's also talking about criminals. You know what I mean? The mind that's always one step ahead. The mind that's always thinking it through. Like, that's the people he's trying to catch. He can't help but like, he loves being a detective. That's what I got from that.
Sure, yeah. But he's talking about her.
Right, but to me, it's very funny that he's like low-key. Like, you know what I love about you, Marla? I love that you're kind of evil in this way. Like an evil genius. I love trying to piece together what your mind is doing and the disgusting evil things that you're thinking about. Like, that's kind of what he's saying there, but I don't think he's doing it maybe on purpose. But that's what I got from it. Within the detail, we have the wonderful Herc and Carve.
Oh, good. Great little Abbott and Costello routine this whole episode, you know.
Oh, I love it. I love it because...
The urban crime environment.
You know? Yeah, the urban crime environment. I love watching them, like... They basically... Herc and Carve go to the, like, tactical sunglasses hut and are like they have to go into their own pockets to do police work, which is an insane thing to me. And then when they
it's
try
like
to
teachers
get...
buying supplies for their students, you know?
Exactly, exactly. It's like teachers are like, I need crayons, and then they're like, do you guys have any good like spy equipment for black like, people?
It's like even worse because it's like they have to go into their own pockets specifically because Valchek lost the van to the guy he's having a pissing contest with, which is the reason they're in a detail.
Yes. Yeah. And, and the only reason that they want this spy equipment is because, they don't like having to sit there. Like they don't like the job of like sitting around listening to people like with it. You cannot use a surveillance device the way they're using it. They're trying to use a surveillance device in order to like cut a corner to pretend it's a confidential informant so they can get more information. It's them basically. They hate police work. They don't like work that they're doing.
They don't like stakeouts, which I don't think most people would.
No, of course not. But also,
you fire up a cigar like Bunk Moreland. You know, as soon as he has to stake out, he just fires up his cigar and he leans back.
But
and...
he hates that shit too. The only people who like it are the weird fucking dudes like Lester and Presbuleski, who are like you know, borderline.
Yeah. Like, speaking of which, great little press moment when he comes out of the strip club and Kima's like, you know, asking a bunch of questions like this. She's like, did you grab that ass or something?
Yeah.
Something like that. Or did you play like an Italian and grab that ass?
Yeah. I was like, did you Italian some people in there?
Give her that dead hand.
Yeah. It's tradition. Yeah, no, I mean, like, yeah, true. The only people who actually enjoy this kind of work are, like, essentially autistic. And, like, both Freeman
they
even, and...
They call him out. They call out Lester for being that. They're like, you don't have to look at all these. They'll tell us, like, when the thing... And he's like, I actually like looking at all of them. You know, like,
I actually like to read my iTunes Terms of Service. You can find out some interesting things about what Apple likes to... What permissions Apple gives you for your files.
I'm telling you, like, he is the like his character comes off so smooth that you forget that at the end of the day he's a guy who's like, well, I quite enjoy making tiny doll furniture and selling it on the internet. Like, he is not a normal guy, and like he's been like looking at the computer. He's like, oh, no, I see the Matrix now, and so. And Herc and Carve are the exact opposite. They're there to like bust heads and chase, and so they put a bug in a tennis ball, and the only to have that tennis ball get thrown
only to record the white guy who thinks he's black from the beginning of the episode.
Yeah,
of all the like, by the way, like they think it's a brilliant idea to put a microphone in a tennis ball, like the thing that people always just pick up and play with and not.
Yeah.
Right, and also, like, as if it's, like, this fucking, oh, it's perfectly hidden. No one would suspect a random tennis ball in the gutter, and it's like, there's not that many sports balls hanging around.
Specifically tennis, ball, either.
Yes, yeah, like, if you see a ball, you're going to play with it. They're lucky they didn't, like, look in to see if there was a fucking bug. But, yeah, immediately it gets thrown and run over by a truck multiple times, which I just absolutely love. And then in the to end it, they I guess they got the plate of Nikki Sabatka. They ran the plate, didn't know it was Nikki, and they traveled to his house, and they realize that it is someone that is part of the detail that they're working on. And I have that clip.
Solicited to Nicholas Andrew Sabatka, 1485 Reynolds Street.
Sabatka?
That's what it says here.
You mean anything to you? Yo, Beavis. That's the name of the guy who was supposed to be working. Frank Sabatka.
We got Nicholas.
How many fucking Sabatkas can there be even down here in Pollock Town?
But Nicholas is a different guy.
Yeah, well, dude, there's one of my favorite subgenres of comedy is like two absolute dumbass, but in which one of them is like slightly smarter than the other, which is the Beavis and Butthead is like the classic one, which they fucking referenced in this. They reference themselves, but like that little subgenre, like Herc and Carver are both idiots. Carver is slightly smarter,
just barely,
like 1 inch. Just like which creates just a hilarious dynamic. Always, it's a great little you can mine that well forever.
Yeah, totally. You could do a whole spinoff of just those guys, like trying to figure shit. I mean, yeah, they are
like Beavis Dumb and Dumber Butthead. Is the same thing, you know. Yes. Like Lloyd is just slightly, you know, more combo. Industrious. Yeah,
it's, yeah. they're a fantastic combo, and they, I mean, they're lucky they remembered Sabatka in at all, so they figure that out, and of course that's going to lead them to. To attach some drugs to the whole thing, which will allow them to, I think, finally get a full on wiretap, because
the show is called
It's the Wire.
Yeah,
that's the name of the show. Finally, we have wire and wires. So yeah, that's the episode. Is there anything that I missed, or is there a favorite scene?
I mean, just that scene where they're following the missing can was pretty exciting. And also, it's like nice as a viewer because you actually understand what the fuck is going on with the can for the first time in this series or in this season. And you're like, oh, I get it now.
Yeah, it definitely was like it was interesting to see them. Piece together something that we as the viewer have already known what was going on, but also seeing like in particular how the crime is pulled off.
The level of complexity that they treat this with in The Wire is like so beyond any other cop show or like even prestige TV. Usually you get like hints and sort of you know, like inferences and assumptions about like what the actual plan is, or it's just like, you know, like super simplistic child level, and this one, like, they're showing you the nuts and bolts of how they're actually pulling off this thing, and you know, it's
while maintaining kind of interesting drama. I was just like, I mean, I was like, again, I haven't watched the previous episodes in a long time. I just kind of came in. I just parachuted into season 2, episode 7. And just amazed by the amount of characters they're able to hold together in a single episode without feeling, you know, that you're getting shortchanged on any of them.
Right.
You know, that you're like, you know, at the end they drop in McNulty and, you know, he's got like some moment. I have no idea what the fuck's going on with this Elena woman or whatever. Yeah. But there's like how many speaking parts are there in this episode? It's 40?
Insane.
Yeah.
Keeping them all together is difficult. And it's, I think, particularly bold to realize that there is only one McNulty scene and he is literally like billed as the lead of the show, you know, and then finally at the end, he only serves to be kind of compared to Daniels, who has that conversation. They're like, McNulty has ruined his relationship, irreparably, because of his commitment to not just being a police guy, but also to being kind of like a philandering piece of shit who drinks too much, to being an Irish scoundrel,
an Irish rogue.
Yes, and Daniels is kind of like realizing that he's in a similar position, of course, or at least they compare them together and go like, oh, he's about to be in the same situation as McNulty, in that like his marriage is going to fall apart because he's so in love with being smarter than criminals. You know, he's so in love with this job where you are just trying to outsmart a bad guy.
A middle school dropout, usually.
Yeah, usually. Exactly. I think one last thing. During Dee's funeral, a guy is singing a song.
On the main line, tell him what you want. Oh, Jesus on the main line, tell him what you want. Jesus on the main line, mind. Tell him what you
incredible.
Want.
Who is that guy? Like, how is he not like a famous and winning billions of dollars?
I mean, that his singing voice is amazing. The song is
yeah, Jesus was on the main line, dude. He's on the horn.
It's literally a song. Jesus on the phone. What? Tell him what's up. Like that, it is just one of those songs where you listening to it and you go like, it's so beautiful, but the content of the song is, what if Jesus had a phone?
Yeah, they tap his wire.
Yeah, exactly. Seriously, they would just that tap
was,
it.
You know, there was a proto God friended me.
Yes, and that, exactly.
It was this.
Yeah, God called me on the phone,
mm-hmm.
and McNulty listened. Hi, this is Jesus. Hey, what do you want? Also, Jesus on the main line, tell him what you want. That means that's a secretary picking up the phone. Hey, Jesus is calling. So in this scenario, Jesus makes his own phone calls, but you have a secretary. Anyways, if I had to rate this episode with a letter grade, and I do, because that's the law, I think I would give it a B+. Vince, what would you give this episode?
Oh, tough question, but I'm going to go solid B+ on this one.
Okay, all right. Yeah. So that's
I don't have to justify it to you.
Yeah, no, you don't.
They could have done a little more to get it into the plus 90 range. I think it's about an 89. Yeah, B+.
B+. All right. Yeah. Well, it's been a solid B+ episode of The Wire and a solid A++++ episode of Pod Yourself. The Wire. Nando, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, talking The Wire with us.
Thanks for having me.
What would you like to plug? I know you have brand new podcast.
Brand new podcast. It's not like a chat podcast. It's not like a fun chat. It's like more of one of these like kind of serialized ones. It's called Shit the Messenger. Tells a story of a Israeli company called NSO Group, which makes a bit of spyware called Pegasus, which turns out was on all of the phones of the entourage of one Jamal Khashoggi.
Yeah.
You know, which they were using to track him and all of his entourage before he was offed. But also,
are you telling me that the Saudis and the Israeli government were working together? No.
Yeah.
No,
they would never do that.
But they hate each other.
But it's crazy, man. This fucking Pegasus shit. You know, it's like they can get into your phone without you having to click anything. This isn't like some fucking John Podesta dipshit phishing scam. This is like nothing. You can't do anything to stop it, and it targets your phone. They can turn it on. They can listen to through the microphone. They can watch through the camera. They can see your keystrokes. Yeah.
Did you see my pee-pee?
Yeah. I do love the idea that there's some Israeli intelligence, you know, like drafted Israeli intelligence people, like 18-year-old men and women who have to watch me masturbate.
They just have an archive of like all the O faces they've ever gotten. Yeah.
Well, that sounds like a dope ass podcast. Is it, when does it come out?
It's already been out, dog. It's four episodes are out. We're doing 10.
Nice.
And it comes out every 2 weeks, and then the season after is about the assassination of the Haitian Prime Minister Jovenel Moïse, which is a fucking wild story.
Yeah, that's a crazy ass story. I still don't know fully what happened there, other than something to do with drugs. I don't know, dog. I thought there was drugs. Doesn't matter. Listen to the podcast.
Yeah,
shoot
the
messenger to find out. Don't listen to Matt Lieb because he don't know. Nando, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Hell yeah. Patreon.com/Frogcast. The $8 tier gets you a shout out. Vince, we don't have any.
Oh, shoot. I had so many nicknames to give.
Oh, you just had them ready?
No, I don't.
That's cheating.
Yeah, no, I don't do that.
So, yeah, we went through, I guess, all of them so far, which means that anyone who's out there listening, what are you doing? Not paying $8 to have your name said on this here podcast here. This very here podcast, buddy. So go to patreon.com/podcast, and not only will and pay $8, but not only will we say your name, but Vince will give you a nickname. Vince, give me a nickname.
Fuckface.
Ooh, that was good. See, you could get something like that if you paid $8.
Beekman.
Beekman. Okay, yeah, I like it.
You look like that guy Beekman from Beekman's World.
Oh, I thought it was because
science.
I thought it was because I had a big. I thought you were doing a Jew thing.
Well, I don't know. Maybe that's what they did with Beekman. Everything about.
I don't know who Beekman is. What's the show?
He was like Bill Nye the Science Guy. There was like two competing science guys back in the day. You don't remember that? There was Bill Nye the Science Guy, and then there was Beekman's World.
I remember
him.
I remember a guy named Mr. Wizard.
Yeah, no, we didn't have that guy. Who the fuck is that?
I don't know. He was Mr. Wizard. He was a.
Beekman had like a sidekick who was a guy in a giant rat costume for some reason.
What the fuck is this show? I don't know this show. Whoa. Oh, and there's a lady. Wait, no, that's a little girl. Okay. No, she's an adult. Why is there a rat guy?
I don't know.
Anyways.
So it's like a weirder version of Bill Nye the Science Guy for some reason.
Yeah. Creepy science. So yeah, patreon.com/broadcast. $8 tier gets you a shout out. Sign up immediately and do it today. And of course, if you're like, wait, what do you mean you have no fucking shout outs? I paid $8 or more and didn't get one. Well, email us and let us know if you fell through the cracks. Broadcast@gmail.com for all your questions, comments, and concerns. Vince, what is the Google Voice number?
415-275-0030.
Alrighty, Roo, everybody. Thanks again so much for listening. And until next time, if you come at the king, you best not miss.
Yeah.
Hello, Barksdale, my old friend. I heard your nephew D is dead. And now your sister softly weeping. You blame yourself because you stopped speaking. In the prison, you let chips fall where they may. He left the game, but we know D was silenced while in the library alone. He was Epstein'd upon a door, choked to death by a DC hitman. He put these hands into his underpants. Now Stringer Bell is free from the threat of a weak-ass guy. He fucks his wife, and that's why D was silenced. And Ziggy fucked Prissy Cat Lowe. She is the local stank-ass whore. Nikki mocks the way that frog's speaking. Herc and Carve are nearby listening. They both buy. By a truck, and now their bug is silence. Fool said Frank, I do not know how to do shit, but Steve adore. Hear my words that I.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.